Stockwell is a homophobe. He's a fascist, and he's a threat to everything and everyone we know. Just because you don't think so doesn't
You don't
mean
know
that I...
what I think. I don't give a shit about Stockwell. But you're not just fucking with him, you're fucking with me. It's my business. Now get the hell out of here.
Still queer as folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Please click subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes. And if you like our show, a 5-star rating really helps us out a lot and helps more people find our show.
Make sure you continue the discussion with us on all of our social media platforms at StillQueerAF, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This episode is called Uncle Ben. It's episode 10 of season 3. There's only 4 more episodes left in season 3, and I can't wait to get to the end of this train wreck of a season.
Train wreck.
I talked about that in the last episode where the writing in this one resembles the writing in season 1, but less interesting.
Oh, because you really think this show starts to jump the shark, especially when Hunter enters the picture.
Yeah.
Well, we will continue on because I'm actually kind of a fan of Hunter. So
Hunter for love.
Hunter.
That was the last episode. Yes.
Uncle Ben first aired in the U.S. on May 18th, 2003.
Uncle Ben was directed by Kevin Inch. He directed 8 episodes of Queer as Folk, and this is his 5th. Also need to mention that he directed 11 episodes of one of my favorite shows, Beverly Hills 90210.
And we're talking about the original 90210, not yes. The one that was recently remade. Yes.
And to be clear, I only really liked the first 3 or 4 seasons. After they grew up and went to college, it was more like Melrose Place. Really
so
like
instead
that.
Of being 25-year-olds in high school, you're more fan of that than when they were 35 and in college. Got it. Cowan and Lippman wrote the story, as they did in every episode this season, and Sean Postoff wrote the teleplay.
Here's what happened in Uncle Ben from Queer as Folk, the book.
Bathhouses are closed up and down the avenue as Stockwell gets the endorsement of the fine, upstanding gay community members.
Michael is overwhelmingly concerned about Melanie's health since she's carrying his child.
I would say obsessed. Mm. Ted goes away for a weekend in the country, but detours at the Paradise Motel for a drug-filled sex party.
I love that. It's a motel.
motel, yes.
Ben takes pity on Hustler Hunter and is about to give up when he finds out that the kid is HIV positive.
The back room at Babylon closes, pushing Justin to start an anti-Stockwell poster campaign.
Point of order there.
Yes, it's a little inaccurate.
He didn't do anything because the back room was closed.
No.
Brian did, but...
Yeah, it took the back room of Babylon for Brian to care.
Uncle Ben has an IMDb viewer rating of 8.6. That's the second highest rating amongst season 3 episodes. I was optimistic going into this episode, and I'm curious to hear what you thought of it, because earlier today you asked me if it would be acceptable to make a GIF of Justin's cum spit.
Yes, his cum spit take. So,
and later on in this episode, we have a new feature, and it's listener voicemail questions, so stick around for it. I gave the A story to Brian and Justin. This episode is one of the first in a while that had the A, B, and C stories mapped according to people. I think the last episode was mapped according to an issue.
Yes, and you and I had a lot of time off mic trying to really figure out what the A story was, the B story was, and it was a little stressful to figure out how we could
break down
that. We
actually stopped recording and fought briefly.
We're like, no, it's this. What are you talking about?
At one point, you threatened to leave.
I was out the door.
This is my A story.
We take this very serious for you listeners.
We do. Justin opens up with a very curious line.
Man cannot live on the back room of Babylon alone. It'll be fun to fuck someplace different for a change.
Okay.
Yes, because he realizes, you know, you can only survive on the back room of Babylon for so long. You gotta spice it up a little.
You know, I wrote down that line because I thought, God, that's fucking stupid. And then I thought about it and I was like, you know what? He's right.
Yeah, sometimes you got to go to the baths. But also in this montage that we go on, and we think we're introduced to a bunch of other places, I'm like, where have they been all this time?
I loved how seedy those bathhouses are. So
I'm going on the assumption that not only were the Liberty Baths bathhouses, obviously, but that's what Adonis was, and the Gravel Pit. They're all just bathhouses.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't just like clubs where they also had, say, a back room like Babylon.
Yeah, I think the term bathhouse is used sort of generally as men's club where guys fuck
each other. Yes.
They may not necessarily have a tub or a dry sauna, hot sauna, a weight room.
Not even a bench. Just stand around, use the floor. And it made me question, first of all, when we saw the entrance to the Liberty Baths, my head went back to when Deb and Jennifer went in there to canvas to look for someone who knew the dead kid in the dumpster.
Jason Kemp.
I was like, so they went down this dark alley to an inconspicuous door, because there's not even a sign, really. There's just a little placard. All the baths are Liberty Baths.
In, like, scary, creepy alleys where there are no people.
Right. And then you take a place like Steamworks in Chicago.
You know what? I wrote that down, too. I swear to God I did.
It's this nice building with a beautiful, like, sort of mechanical kind of facade.
Industrial,
yes. Yeah. Industrial facade. And it doesn't have its name anywhere. It just has its address.
Right.
And we all know.
You can, the upstairs windows, the third floor windows, you can see that there's a gym up there.
Yes. In the third floor of Steamworks, there is a gym.
My note that I wrote down, it's so funny that you mentioned this, is Chicago is rather blessed to have a pretty upscale bathhouse called Steamworks. P.S. We're open to show sponsors, by the way.
I mean, and Steamworks is a chain, so you can find a local Steamworks in any major metropolitan city. But we also have had our seedy bathhouses. Man's Country, may it rest in peace, was just that. That actually did have a small marquee, but from what I've been told, was a place akin to the Liberty Baths.
It's being replaced by million-dollar condos now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tore the building down.
Did you know that Man's Country was almost my backyard? When I was searching for condos, I landed on one that, like, was amazing. I was super interested in getting it. And they told me, like, oh, yeah, and over there is Man's Country. And I just laughed. I was like, that would have been amazing.
Is there a back door?
I was like, do you mean that my backyard is now a private entrance?
Alleyway blowjobs are fun.
I'm a fan.
Justin is blowing Brian and catches his load. And I thought he held that load in his mouth for an unusually long amount of time and then spat it out on a Stockwell poster.
My jaw dropped when that happened, because I saw him. Clearly, Brian has come. And Justin, he has that load in his mouth. And I'm like, what is he going to do? Is he going to do like some cum swapping? Are we going to hear a huge gulp just so Brian can hear it? Like, what's going to happen? And he comes up very slowly, takes a slight look at the left, and just this giant load all over the poster. And I could not believe
it. What was that sound you just made?
That's what it was. That's what it was. And I was just like, what? That's amazing.
I kind of wish it was a bigger load, though. It looked kind of...
It got a little watered down because of saliva and everything, but something tells me it was pretty hefty for it to show up on the poster the way it did. But I also thought, like, what an incredibly strong image to have this load that came from a gay man blowing another gay man in a dark alley to land on Stockwell's face.
I like the metaphor, but then I was also thinking, why is a Stockwell poster in the dark alley? What is Stockwell hiding?
Yes. I mean, again, we have talked and over numerous episodes about the homoeroticism that exists between Stockwell and Brian. And again, I am waiting on the moment that Stockwell just bends the fuck over.
Totally could have brought that character back, like, way down the line.
Yes, and he's in the Liberty Baths and just taking
just
it
like the priest.
Ass. Yeah. That's still hot.
I think we hear for the first time in this episode that Brian has had an STI.
Missed you at Babylon last night.
Well, you know, it was such a lovely evening. Justin and I decided to take a stroll.
Oh, he should have been there.
I hear it was an overflow crowd.
Filled to capacity.
What was the enticement? Free airline miles for every cock you suck?
There's nowhere else to go. Stockwell's closed down half the street.
And you've empowered him to do it.
Frankly, he's doing us a favor. The gravel pit was always a skank hole. The only thing I ever picked up there was a case of crabs.
I don't think that we have ever known that before.
Well, because we knew
Michael had.
Yes.
He got crabs at the white party.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael and Brian have both had crabs. So we need to keep a running list of the STIs that the gang gets.
Okay. So we know Michael.
Crabs.
Crabs.
Brian.
Brian.
Crabs. Hunter.
HIV.
Ben.
HIV. Vic. HIV.
Yep. Don't think we've heard from Emmett.
Not yet. Ted had an HIV scare.
That's right.
But he has not actually caught anything yet.
Okay, so let's keep that list going.
So two crabs and three HIVs. We now have a tote board.
There were some comments from Ben and Emmett that struck me as a little bit hyperbolic. So here's Ben's.
That's not the point. Our world's being taken away from us.
Ben, stop being a drama queen.
I mean, I think
first of all, Ben's not in that world so much.
Not as much.
Not anymore.
But he was talking about how where they used to have an entire street that was dedicated to just their community has dwindled and dwindled and dwindled and dwindled to where Babylon is at capacity. And I'm like, first of all, I feel like it's always been kind of at capacity. Like everyone has spent their night in some way at Babylon.
Yeah, there's only one late night bar there, I guess.
And yeah, and once you leave that bar, you decide to either go home with someone or you go to the baths. But I understand his point. I think he's trying to speak a little bit in hyperbole to maybe crack through Brian.
Well, here's Emmett's hyperbolic statement.
And that includes our right to fuck wherever we want.
Is that actually a right?
You can just fuck
on the sidewalk or?
So I
just thought it was hyperbolic in that in these two cases, it seemed like Postoff was trying a bit too hard to state the impact of Stockwell's actions, which, by the way, how does the police chief shut down bathhouses anyway? That's like the health department or something, right? Or the licensing department.
This is the thing with the series where they're like, well, we need to place it in the hands of someone and we have this antagonist, so it has to be his fault.
They were consistent because they do position it as a police state. So,
we see in that interaction that Justin and Brian have with the police officer who has to see Justin's ID. And this time he isn't lying about his age. And he is 19.
Yeah.
And the way the police officer just says party's over and just chucks the ID at Justin and walks away, you can tell that there is animosity between the two communities and Brian's sort of brushing it off.
Well, here's something interesting, though, is that Babylon apparently is capitalizing on the increased police presence by having uniform night.
Yeah, so I was like, that's either they're doing it as a fuck you or no, I feel like I can't give them that much credit.
Well, I kind of thought, okay, use... policemen dancing in sequence, doing a routine.
Yes.
To illustrate the police state, to reinforce that Liberty Avenue has become police state.
Yeah, it was an image a little on the nose.
Yeah.
But it was at that same dance party that some shirtless man approaches both Brian and Justin.
You're under arrest for the possession of illegal drugs.
I have a better idea. Why don't we go to the back room and play good cock, bad cock?
Oh.
Wait, was it actually an undercover police officer? Because they set that up so the camera can follow this guy who clearly makes a path to Brian.
He was real, he would have pulled out a badge like they did in Woody's.
Yeah, okay. Because then he might have been
playing uniform night.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, because he just gave up real easily. And I think it was a little muddled for me.
I kind of glossed over that because, I don't know, it just, I'm like, uniform night, what? And then it carried the theme through. Mm-hmm. And then it was just kind of weird. Yeah. I was more interested, though, in that Justin left. So Postoff is trying to build up some suspense in the story. Justin takes off because he had to take care of something. We don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the mystery theme. But then he blew it 2 minutes later by showing Justin in action putting up the posters.
Yeah, we then know, oh, okay, Justin is the one putting up the posters. Like, there was no build-up to this mystery.
Well, it shifted to us knowing, but not the other characters knowing. So it wasn't all that bad. I always like those things where we know something that they don't know.
Don't you think it was a little obvious?
Well, yeah, because right away, one look from Brian tells us that He's got an inkling about who's drawing these. He knows Justin's drawing style.
Yes. Inkling meaning it's Brian picks up on it in the first 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. I wish that mystery would have gone a little bit further. Later on, Justin comes face to face with Stockwell in that conference room. That was chilling.
Before we break down what goes on, did you notice? I noticed this little prop thing that cracked me up. As Justin is handing out all of the proposals and folders for the table, he opens up one of them and you can see inside there's a piece of paper. It just says in bold letters, proposal.
Okay, bad prop moment then. We missed Tanya Lemke.
It was a moment that I think just so happened to just make it into the frame, and I just could not stop laughing looking at it.
Why don't you find a still frame of that and we'll post that.
Yes, so I'll be sharing that on all of our social medias too, so our listeners can see what I'm talking about.
Proposal.
This is a proposal.
Just like Melanie is law.
Yes, and Ted is accountant. Like, it cracked me up. But I love the fact that you point out the Stockwell almost like Hitler coming into the room, because that's how he's getting compared. And then I found it very strong connection to our current political situations.
Yeah, it's pretty close to home with some of the language that was being used in 2003. It was hyperbolic then. Now it's real.
It's like this is happening. Like, the fact that it's a literal Nazi comparison to what Stockwell is doing. 2003, we're like, okay, that's a bit much. Here we're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
2018.
Here we are.
We're losing our minds going, yeah, that's a thing. That is happening right now.
Yeah. We relate to this story.
Very much so.
That's part of our mantras. Does the show hold up? Yes.
And that's terrifying. It shouldn't, but it is right now.
It didn't take long for Brian to catch Justin in the act. Brian does have a point about this inherent conflict of interest involved in having Stockwell as a client and Justin, the intern, running this insurgency campaign out of the same office.
Using their copiers, no less.
Which, yeah. So he had a point.
Stockwell is a homophobe. He's a fascist and he's a threat to everything and everyone we know. Just because you don't think so doesn't
You don't
mean
know
that
I... what I think. I don't give a shit about Stockwell. But you're not just fucking with him, you're fucking with me. It's my business. Now get the hell out of here.
I thought an option here for Postoff would have been to say, you can't do this here, but here's $100. Go to Kinko's.
Yes, do anything
something
to
like
get
that.
Him. Yeah, something to at least not make it so obvious that the ad agency could be implicated. Because if a single poster was left there and Stockwell, who comes to that office frequently, finds it.
I don't think Brian was entirely won over at this point, which I got a note on the moment where he does get won over.
Yeah.
There's something here that I thought was really, really bizarre, which is when the Gay and Lesbian Center endorses Stockwell. That just seemed like a stretch to me because it's based solely on cleaning up Liberty Avenue. But it's hard to believe that any LGBTQ, et cetera, organization would ever get anywhere near something like that.
I get what you're saying, but this was at a point where we were in this effort to try and be more palatable to the straight community. So, I mean, we saw it in the way they were supporting Howard Bellwether. Because they thought he was someone who railed against all of the quote unquote stereotypes of the promiscuity of the gay community. And then we find him at a bareback party, just sharing loads. And so to me, it made a lot of sense that there would be these groups who want to show like, look, we can be just as wholesome and family oriented as a gay community. And you don't have to fear us. But that's the one thing that Brian has always been so vocally against. So I think that really stuck in his craw. When Stockwell said Tannis, you saw Brian's face go like, motherfucker. Yeah.
I know her. There's a weak tie up to this arc where Brian can't get into the back room. So he goes in search of Justin and helps him put up Stockwell posters.
I can't fuck in the back room at Babylon. Now I'm mad.
Where's Justin?
What?
I'm going to help him put up these posters.
I was like, that just makes Brian look like such an ass. He can't put his dick somewhere in public. So now he's mad.
There's a quick note about the music in this scene and the music that played over the credits. It was a song called Walking on Thin Ice by Yoko Ono. So most of her music is basically unlistenable. They're art pieces. It's an art installation. Mm-hmm. But for the past decade, DJs have loved remixing her songs, and she's actually had a string of super popular charting dance songs for like the past 10 years. And it was just great to see one in Queer as Folk. This one was remixed by Danny Tenaglia.
Still Queer as Folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Still Queer as Folk. There's more on the way. We have a new segment that we want to introduce today, and that's viewer questions. So let's listen to our first.
Hi, guys. This is Jim from Northeastern Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for the great podcast. My question is actually regarding renewal of each of the seasons. I'm wondering if there's any record of when seasons were renewed. And the reason why I wonder that is kind of my second question. To what impact did renewal have on the overall development of storylines? Thanks.
So thanks for your question. Around March 2001, Showtime ordered 20 more episodes of the show beyond the first 22 from season one. That was right when episode 13 of season one was airing. It was called Very Stupid People, and it's the one where Brian fucks his subordinate, Kip, on his desk. Mm-hmm. So that brings us all the way up through seasons one and two. In June 2004, Showtime announced that they bought 32 more episodes to make up seasons 3 and 4. All the actors had 5-year deals, so season 5 was really just about wrapping up the show and freezing those characters in time, which is also why I'm not at all interested in a reunion or a reboot with the same characters. So real quick, a little bit about how television writing works relative to renewals. Seasons are usually looked at as a whole. The writers break the season well in advance of shooting, even the first episode. Breaking the season means establishing the journey that these characters are going to go on. From there, the writing team starts to break episodes. These are usually short-term obstructions that the characters face while trying to reach the goals of the season arc that was previously broken out. From there, a member of the writing staff is assigned to write the teleplay, which takes the story and puts it into a script that can be photographed. In Queer as Folk, season 2+, Conan Lippman did all the story writing with support from a team of writers that would contribute and crank out the teleplays. So to answer Jim's question, the initial season-long story is usually established before anyone knows if the show will be back next season. But in this case, though, all the seasons were renewed in the middle of the preceding season. So their original story ideas fit right into that. This allowed the writers to carry over stories into the next season, like with cliffhangers. Like season one had Justin getting bashed. Season two had Justin leaving Babylon with Ethan. Season three has a mayoral election. And we'll skip season 4 and 5 because we haven't gotten there that far yet in the show. But you can see that in the first 3 seasons, the stories are clearly designed to continue season over season. Season 5 is just about not continuing the show. So it's kind of the opposite of that. They knew the show was ending. They wrote the entire season to end the show. So thanks so much for your question, Jim. If you have a question, you can visit us at stillqueerasfolk.com/hello.
We'd love to hear from you.
You can leave a voicemail that we'll play in the air, or if you're uncomfortable leaving a voicemail and appearing in front of hundreds of thousands of Queer as Folk fans, just leave us a written comment. We'll do our best to answer it.
Still Queer as Folk.
So we get a bit of a ruckus when it comes to Ted trying to make his way to the social gym. As the rest of the group is discussing what's going on in terms of businesses closing at on Liberty Avenue, we hear Ted in a very heated discussion with the desk attendant.
Okay, will you please calm
down? No, I will not calm down.
I am just doing what I'm told.
I want to see the fucking manager now. Now!
Hey, what's wrong? What's going on?
They won't let me in.
We got an insufficient funds notice from the bank when we tried to bill his account.
That's bullshit.
I'm sure it's just a mix-up. We will get you a guest membership for now.
You know what? I've been coming here for 9 years. 9 years. You think you could show a little respect? No, fuck you and your membership.
Sorry about that.
Honey, you should see the carnage when yoga sells out.
I feel like, are we starting to finally get a somewhat of a stronger timeline when it comes to what, how long this group has been here? Or do you think that was just an arbitrary 9 years to show how long he's been going to this gym?
I bet we can figure out some of that, because we know Brian and Michael went to elementary school together.
Right. They grew up together.
We knew that Emmett came in from Hazelhurst, Mississippi in his early 20s.
Mm-hmm. And then and he met Godiva, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he got his introduction to Liberty Avenue.
We should try to put together a real timeline.
Yes. I feel like we're finally getting the pieces. We also know Brian and Lindsay's history.
Yep.
And so she ties herself there.
We go all the way back to Debbie when she was 17 with Gary Beach, the drag queen.
Yes.
What was the drag queen's name?
Davina
DeVore.
Thank you. I was like, it's two D's. It's double D. So Ted then storms out because obviously he's embarrassed, and it leaves Emmett to sort of make an apology to the desk attendant. And I love what the desk attendant says at this moment. Honey, you should see the carnage when yoga sells out.
I've actually seen that in action at my social gym.
Isn't yoga supposed to be for relaxing?
I don't like the yoga crowd at my gym.
Ooh.
They're just really snippy. They always tend to be finishing up their class as I'm arriving at the gym. And they all come down into the locker room with their yoga mats.
And they're just not having it, apparently?
The spin class people are much more interesting. They come down exhausted. They just want to like relax and leave.
Have you ever taken a spin class?
Yeah.
I love it.
I hate it.
I'm a fan of it. I feel like I really actually get a workout when I do it.
We're going to have to revisit that in a little while, in like a year, when we get to the Liberty ride.
Yes.
So still no job for Ted.
No. And this.
Let the downward spiral begin.
Well, it has been beginning, and it's an oddly traditional thing in this storyline that I've been trying to figure out. So we have Emmett, who is being very successful as a party planner. He's very good at it. He's getting all these higher profile clients who want him to do their parties for them, which is great. And considering how much love Ted has for Emmett and Emmett has for Ted, I've been trying to figure out this effect it's having on Ted, that he's not the main breadwinner, and that like he almost feels like less of a man, and that he's not the one who is being the provider, but now it's Emmett. So I was wondering, could you break down? Do you have any thoughts on why it's having such an adverse effect on Ted that he can't be the one who's the
I had some issues with the accelerating pace of this, and we're left to think that it's only about money. So it works with the overall story arc, because if Ted had turned into a crystal queen overnight, it just wouldn't have worked.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little unbelievable that he can't find work of any kind whatsoever.
Yeah, because I feel like the tabloids and headlines of why he had been arrested sort of have dissipated.
Yeah, and maybe that's a 2018 view of this, where if you ran a porn company and you had unknowingly an underage employee, you think anybody'd really care these days?
Yeah, especially if you've been acquitted or you've been
adjudicated.
You adjudicate, yeah. Like you've gone through it, you've paid your debt to society, we've moved on. But I feel
somebody
like
somebody would hire him, right?
That's yes. I mean, I'm surprised that
another porn company.
Well, as
for example,
I feel like they probably would have.
Is he blackballed from the industry?
Yeah, probably blackballed. I would have thought that maybe Melanie would have had a job as
bookkeeper at the law firm.
Yeah, as she is law and partner at law.
She has lots of contacts, lots of
yeah.
Clients.
That something would have come up for him at this point. It's getting to the point where they're trying to just put Ted in the dumps, so he can then make
the bad choices.
So we know that Emmett is offering to take Ted to the country for the weekend. A weekend in the country, like like the song in A Little Night Music.
Let's go to Dr. David Cameron's abandoned cabin.
Yeah.
Because he moved away.
Yes,
what happened to the cabin?
Yeah, it's just, I thought he sold it, but maybe it's just collecting cobwebs. He forgot all about it. We see that Ted was going through his emails, and he deletes a message from some invite to a sex party at the Paradise Motel. And he makes, some snide comments about what goes on there. And what cracks
me up. He's one of Pittsburgh's hottest.
Sex pigs.
Sex pigs, yeah. He's a suck pig, though, not a sex pig.
Yes. Maybe. And yeah, so I think maybe that's why he got misinvited. But Emmett wants him to go to this weekend in the country, and then Emmett gets a job. So Emmett wants him to go by himself and just sort of regroup, relax, not have to worry about anything.
I thought that was a bad choice on Emmett's part. You can't send somebody in Ted's state off alone into the country.
Yeah, that was a little odd. As Ted is going, he comes across, by chance, the Paradise Motel.
Ta-da.
And so Ted takes this moment to drive in, and he's going to get a room. But he just sort of stays in his room for a while. He goes to get ice, and that's where he somehow turns the corner to the sex rooms. I guess they're on their own floor in some way.
Well, actually, I wanted to comment on this.
Yes.
The interesting thing about Ted is that as he's making his way through this episode, everything is getting slower and slower and slower. He's becoming more deliberate. He's speaking slowly. He's looking around slowly. He's speaking in a tone that we've never heard before, because without aim in his life, the world is in slow motion around him. And that contrasted perfectly with the hyper-fast world of crystal meth that he had just walked into. So it's really, really good storytelling there, that everything is just kind of going around him up to this moment.
That's a very interesting observation. Now it makes you want to go back and watch the episode, or at least watch those moments with
even
that
the
in
sex
mind.
Scenes that yes. he was walking past were like in slow, synchronized swimming motion.
And we see that all the doors are open.
Yeah, I like the dangerous feel of that motel.
Yeah, but and this is what I think the episode does a really great job of, is showing how unenticing it looks to be on hard drugs while having anonymous sex. It felt grimy walking past all those rooms.
I thought the environment was grimy. At this point, Ted's fully clothed. Everyone else is in towels.
Mm-hmm. They're hot, aren't they? So beautiful. I'm beautiful. Everything's fucking beautiful. You want to be beautiful?
And then at that first snort of crystal, all the colors become saturated.
Yes, it was literally a shot of euphoria.
Ted becomes like sexually attractive. He's desired by everyone. The pace picks up mm-hmm. to faster than real speed. It was just really nicely shot and directed. I didn't see the grime other than the venue.
Right. No, that's what I'm talking about.
And the venue got better the moment that he did that
right,
first little.
Yeah, he's in a drug-induced state. But yeah. Was he snorting crystal or was he snorting cocaine?
It was crystal.
Oh, I thought that was cocaine.
They introduced it as crystal.
Oh, okay. Then I got a little confused in the drug situation, because like when he's at the
crystal boner cocaine limp, for future reference. I've read about this.
I was gonna say I've never done these drugs, so I would not know, Patrick.
Well, I'm a scholar.
Oh, a gentleman and a scholar.
Yes.
And there was something about that shot where it shows Ted giving in to the orgy, and that the ear, nose, and throat doctor that he met at the vending machine is sort of overlooking, not participating, but observing.
Oh yeah, he's the devil on his shoulder.
Literally the devil in disguise.
Totally.
And I've told you about this, Patrick. It reminded me very much of Suspiria.
Oh, you're not going to talk about that again. You're going to give me nightmares.
Listeners, if you have not seen this remake of Suspiria, I can't stop thinking about it. I think it's fascinating. But yes, it felt very much like this is a man who, I've gained another victim into this very dangerous world, and he's giving into it. That's what was very chilling to me.
What I liked about this scene is that it really reinforced that old notion that free is the most expensive.
Mm-hmm.
He gets it for free.
Yes.
And it ends up being the single most expensive mistake of his life. It far eclipses the porn company and Eddie.
Because the final straw for Ted to give in to this doctor was, makes everything beautiful. Do you want to be beautiful? And that's what pushes Ted to do it. And so I've been trying to unpack what exactly that means for Ted. Those words.
That's why I think he was written and shot as going down this downward spiral into nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
I think the season three writers in general needed to take him all the way down to the bottom to where he had nowhere else to go. So this turned into a, well, might as well moment that had major repercussions in the next several episodes and even in, throughout the rest of the series. You have to bring somebody down in order to get them into these states of being able to save themselves. And here it was kind of a little awkward journey for Ted, but I liked it. And I liked the absolute wreck that he was the next morning when he got home.
Sunglasses and eating the donut.
How could Emmett have no earthly idea
of what he was on or what he was coming down that he was from on or something? Yeah, I thought is Ted going to play this off like, oh, I enjoyed myself a little too much. I had a little too much to drink and I'm hungover or something like that.
Somebody hit Emmett with the stupid stick.
Yeah, I feel like Emmett is a little more savvy to understand. He knows a tweaker when he sees one. And this also starts to speak, and this is something that I think the series is still makes it still prevalent, is the heavy drug use that still exists in the gay community, especially Crystal. Like, we see all the time party and play, PNP on all these different apps.
Skeen. Listeners, if you see anything like that, don't go anywhere near it.
Believe me when I say, like, you, and I can speak from experience, you know when you realized, oh God, I'm with someone who is on drugs.
Run for the door.
How do I get out of this?
Leave immediately.
Yes.
Yeah, and I will draw you back to that party that Justin went to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you disagreed with me at the time, but you just made my point for me just a season later. When you see somebody that's on drugs and they want to hook up with you, or you see people on drugs hooking up, run away.
Now.
God, we sound like old men here.
Yes, we do. Get those gall darn drugs off our lawn. Suffice to say, I'm not looking forward to Ted's path for the rest of the season. This is where things get real sad for me.
Still queer as folk.
One of the runners in the story was Ben and Hunter, with Michael as a supporting character. I like this story. I think that Robert Gant and Harris Allen actually have some decent acting chemistry with each other. They just play off each other really nicely.
I'm a huge fan of this Hunter storyline. I know you're not really. You think this is where the show really jumps the shark, but I like the introduction of his character in the sense that it shakes things up a little bit, because it's also one of the characters that we get to see around for a long time. Everybody else we get introduced to sort of plays their part and leaves. And I always feel it's very abrupt. Here, I feel like we get an opportunity to see it develop.
Hunter reminds me of a Degrassi character. He's like cute, flawed, tortured, but we still root for him.
Well, and it's really funny because I was thinking about his introduction of this episode to the Fosters. Oddly enough, created by Peter Page, because it explores the idea of an older orphan and the effect that has on someone who doesn't have their parents but is older. That, and I like that he points out, it's like, they want some cute 3-year-old. They're not going to want me, this 16-year-old hard-edged kid who has been selling his body for money. And I wondered if that was a little bit of an inspiration for Peter Page on the Fosters, because some of the kids that are on that show go through very tough life lessons.
Michael's anger about Ben being a good person and taking pity on Hunter just keeps pissing me off.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
He just Michael comes across as so yippy. He's like a little dog. Like,
he's like, you can't be bothered to help him. He's going to take advantage of you. Like,
some of the words that he was using with Ben, I didn't like at all.
So what's with the billing info?
I told them I'd pay for it.
Well, how much is it?
It's a couple thousand.
A couple of thousand? Are you out of your mind? Why you?
They think that I'm his uncle.
And why do they think that?
Because I said so. Michael, if I hadn't, they would have put him in some god-awful county facility.
I don't want to hear about it. This kid is not your responsibility.
He was in trouble. He needed help.
And there you were, charging to the rescue. Well, you're going to go back down there and tell them the truth. And they're going to call family services or whoever the fuck, because we're not getting involved. Not. Do I make myself understood?
I was like, who the fuck do you think you are?
It's great, though, that Ben just goes ahead and does it anyway.
Well, he's going to the hospital to come clean about not being Hunter's uncle and to try and get out of actually being responsible for him. But then the news comes that Hunter is HIV positive, and that affects Ben in such a way that that's all he has to say to Michael. And Michael, thank God, shut his fucking mouth and started apologizing right away.
I thought that was just bad storytelling, though.
I mean, he turns on a dime very, very, very quickly, and I would have liked for Ben to have stuck it to Michael a little more.
Yeah, because as much as I hated Michael being yippy, I just wish that he would have gotten more yippy with Ben after hearing that. Yeah,
well, even more reason why we can't take it.
Exactly. Then,
to have that kind of wedge would have been a little more dramatically
interesting. Yeah, something to put their own relationship at risk in taking on this protector role. Yeah.
Instead, it makes Michael put the tail between his legs, and he turns down real quickly.
I like that Ben was just taking this risk, though, because he was putting his relationship with Michael at risk. So that was decent writing. Postoff put up this big obstacle to Ben getting involved, and he has to solve it. It's not one of these dog bones that so often get thrown at the characters, and there's no consequence or there's no obstruction in their way to doing it. They just accomplish it by the end of the episode.
Right.
And this one actually had some real live obstacles, even though Michael's obstacle was kind of like, shut up, Michael.
Which is what I say about half the time with Michael.
There was great treatment of Ben struggling to figure out how to tell Hunter that he's positive. There's some mature writing.
There are no right words to take away the one illusion every kid is entitled to. His invincibility. His immortality.
I like the mini cliffhanger where Ben and Michael go to the hospital to tell him and he's gone.
Yes, and they don't know what to do with it. It makes me actually worry for Hunter.
There was one other runner in this episode, and I called it Dykes and Mike. It wasn't surprising to me that Michael was overreacting to Melanie and the fetus.
He's fucking insane.
But I thought the writing tracked well here. That was what we would expect from Michael. So for once, I thought the writing staff had a little bit of rearview mirror about who Michael is and why he acts the way he does.
Now, I will go with you on that. But what then turned me off to the whole thing is that we acknowledge that he is crazy and that he is stalking Mel at the most random times, but he's then ostensibly rewarded for doing so because he helps Mel in a time of need. And she then realizes that, oh, you know what? I should rest and I can't do this case. And she said at the beginning of this that she's only 10 weeks pregnant, which is like drove me nuts about this runner is that it then turns incredibly smug against Melanie when she finally acknowledges, like, you know what? You're right. I should rest. I need to take some time. And Lindsay's response to the whole thing was just so smug. And I was like,
maybe if it would have come later in the pregnancy.
Yeah.
Late second trimester.
That would have made so much more sense. But she's like a couple of months pregnant. Let's calm the fuck down.
Well, and with Michael, too, it was really creepy that he's stalking her.
He just appears. Like,
but why doesn't he just offer to help?
Like, yes.
He's can I pick up the groceries for you?
Can I do this for you? Can I do that? Like, that would have... No, but Michael has got to go the childish way because he's a child still. They agreed to let him be the sperm donor, and I still don't understand that. You'll see when we go through our recap that when I posted that poll, a lot of people agreed that that was not the right choice.
We get some backstory on Debbie here that I liked, where she's telling Michael about being pregnant at 17 and working nonstop until Michael popped out of her womb. But I thought that this was a great moment that would have been nice to hear about Michael's drag queen father.
Something. I would have loved to have seen Davina again.
Yeah, it's just never mentioned. Bring Gary Beach back for a day.
Yeah.
Go talk to your father about this, Michael. So hits and misses for this episode. What's your hit?
My hit was the cum spit take. I was such a fucking fan of that moment because one, highly unexpected. And I think the imagery was incredibly striking and really sets up the journey that Justin goes on and how activated he was to fight against Stockwell.
When you messaged me about that, I think the message was something like, what do you think of a GIF of the cum spit? And I hadn't watched the episode yet.
And you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? And I was like, this moment at the top of the episode where Justin is taking Brian's load and spits it in Stockwell's face. Sorry, his face is just on a poster. He wasn't like there with them.
Oh, that's too bad.
That would have been hot.
So my hit was Ben and Hunter. I thought that this was some great writing and an unexpected story. And I like the seriousness of it. Big yes.
My miss, I just mentioned the whole Mel storyline. It made me angry. Everyone was using this pregnancy against Mel. And I think it really diminishes what it's possible for a woman who is pregnant to continue to raise a family, to continue to work. It's possible. People do it all the time. That it took such an attitude against Mel as she sort of cowers in defeat with it, that it completely turned me off.
My miss was a little bit of an overarching one of what you said. Mm-hmm. It's Michael overreacting to basically everything in this episode. First, he overreacts to Melanie, then Ben, and then completely does a U-turn on both, all within one episode. We need to see more causality with Michael. Otherwise, he just comes across as a lunatic. So that was a miss for me. This has been episode 10 of season 3, and it's called Uncle Ben.
Next time, Stockwell meets the gay community, which doesn't go well.
Brian is fired from the company.
Ted's drug use escalates.
Ben and Michael tell Hunter that he is HIV positive. That will be episode 11 of season 3, and it's called Poster May Lead to the Truth.
And remember, we're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook and continue the discussion at StillQueerAsFolk.
Find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Matthew PD.
Thanks for listening. If you did enjoy your time with us, please subscribe and click 5 stars. And a review would be helpful too. Every positive review helps more people find the show. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.